Today we're starting a series, two or possibly three, depending on how many detours I make, how much digression we have. We just have a loose framework, and then we feel free, we go this way, tell a story if it comes to mind, just kind of have fun with it, but not to keep too much to the script. This is called The Big Picture, and I'd like to thank Mona Gupta of Sydney, Australia, who prettied it up, as she says. I do the text and the graphics and send it to her, and she pretties it up and puts all of our own personal logos on it and sends it back to me. So thank you very much, Mona. And we also welcome feedback and comments from these PowerPoints. They're on iTunes, they're on the website, they're on the ISKCON Desire Tree, so a lot more people listen to them than are physically present here. So we just make this announcement in case anyone wants to give us any feedback. Write us at utahkrishnas@gmail.com. Also, there are many people who are interested in membership in this particular temple, but they live far parts of the world. But we do have a membership PowerPoint and a membership class that we send out, one or two of those every week by email, for people to listen to them and to see the visuals, and if they so choose to actually join this temple. The latest member that we had join is Robert Telford from Savannah, Georgia. Is that in Georgia or North Carolina? I think it's Georgia. So thank you, Robert. And Robert is also transcribing lectures too, doing service from his remote location. All of our talks are based on the teachings of His Divine Grace, A.C. Bhaktivedanta Swami Prabhupada, the founder Acharya of the International Society for Krishna Consciousness. Prabhupada visited us in Australia my first 5 years, and Vaibhavi's first 5 years of our Krishna consciousness took place in Australia, where we happened to be when we first met devotee missionaries in downtown Sydney. We became active, and Prabhupada visited, I think, twice when I was there, two or three times when I was there, and then many times after I came back to America in 75. But in 1972, there was a place in Potts Point. Potts Point was kind of also in itself had some notoriety. It was where all the soldiers who were on R&R from Vietnam went and spent their Saturday nights. And another thing that was popular on Saturday nights was a place called the Wayside Chapel, run by Reverend Ted Knopfs. In fact, this is not Ted Knopfs. I couldn't find a picture of Ted. He may even have passed on. This is his successor. But it was a place where a lot of different radical people would gather, Nazis and homosexuals. And one thing they all had in common was they loved to make a lot of ruckus and stand up and pontificate and shout each other down. And it was such a melee that actually it was very popular. They could seat about 400 people, and you had to get there at least 20 minutes beforehand just to get a seat. I don't know how much genuine spirituality transpired, but it was quite a show anyway, and it certainly served to keep their roles up and keep it on the forefronts of people's mind. So I had an engagement arranged for Prabhupada to come and speak at the Wayside Chapel, and that morning he'd spoke at a very exclusive boys' school, the North Sydney Boys' School. So he had a morning program and an evening program. And the boys were seated in an amphitheater. They were dressed in nice jackets and ties. Not very old, I think quite young, in fact, between the ages of 7 and maybe 13 at the most. And the whole school was there. And Prabhupada spoke quite elaborately and quite detailed on the fifth verse of the 13th chapter of the Bhagavad Gita about the owner of the body and the proprietor of the body. And it's a detailed verse, and it's quite technical. And Prabhupada went into all these technicalities with the boys, and I was pretty amazed. So, and then that evening we went to the Wayside Chapel where so-called all the sophisticates hung out, you see. So I thought, well, if he gave that sophisticated talk to the boys, he's really going to do something. And he didn't. He spoke very briefly. He just sensed the mood, the lack of respect, the cynical posture of most of the people, and also the fact that many of them were way far gone in terms of sinful activities. So he spoke very simply, just gave a basic "you're not this body" message, and then he just asked for questions. And one of the people in the audience, he just shouted and yelled about all the mumbo jumbo and the needlessness of it and this and that and the other thing. And finally, he ended his rant with the question, "What is the practical good of this Krishna consciousness movement with all of its temples and all of its members?" And Prabhupada just sort of whipped out, he just sort of barked out without going into any details or anything. He said, it saves you from death. It saves you from death. That is the practical good. So what on earth is Krishna doing? What is the big picture? What is it all about? We have 400 branches of ISKCON. ISKCON stands for International Society for Krishna Consciousness. Anywhere you go to India, if you're in a medium-sized or large city and you want to go to a place where there's a beautiful restaurant, prasadam, there's some Westerners who can articulate the ancient teachings of the Bhagavad Gita and Sanatana Dharma, where there's beautiful music and dioramas and exhibits and architecture, just ask the rickshaw driver, take me to the nearest ISKCON temple. And he will know exactly what you're talking about, the local branch of the International Society for Krishna Consciousness. So what is Krishna doing on earth? Or what on earth is Krishna doing throughout these 400 centers? We're not manufacturing anything. In an age when your worth is based on your output and your gross national product, when a growing, robust economy is based on sales, 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 and paper money with green ink on it, we're not part of that. We contribute virtually nothing to the manufacturing sector, to the gross national product, to the import and the export. In fact, when I go to India, I usually go every January. There are so many devotees, so many new joinees in the temples, hundreds and hundreds of them, many of them graduates from India Institute of Technology, the best college in the world. There are instances where people have failed to get entrance into the Indian Institute of Technology, and they've been given full scholarships at Harvard and MIT. And there are a number of those boys who have joined the Krishna Conscious Movement in the hundreds, in the hundreds. I was in Pune, which is in Maharashtra, east of Bombay, for a month in January. And the temple president, Radhe Shyam, who himself is an IIT graduate, he said, we've got so many brahmacharis, single celibate students, that they're practically sleeping on top of each other. He had just got back from Calcutta. Calcutta is about 2,000 miles away from Pune. He just opened a satellite of the Pune temple. He has to open temples all the time in order to make sleeping space in the home temple for new people that are joining. So there are literally hundreds, if not thousands, of people that live in the temple, in the temples in India. Many of them are more highly educated than anyone else in the world. And yet they're not lending their expertise to technology or engineering or computer science. They're not involved in the workforce. They're not earning. They're not spending money. They're not paying taxes. They're not keeping the economy going. And above and beyond the fact that we're not manufacturing anything, that we're not earning and paying taxes and contributing to the circulation and flow of currency, above and beyond the fact, although we do social work, it's not our main purpose. It's not the main reason that we exist. Here's a picture of one of the Akshaya Patra trucks. This is a program that began in Bangalore. The kids were truant in schools. Thousands and thousands of kids were truant in the school system. The reason for that was you can't go to school if you're hungry. You can't study if you're hungry. Because of lack of proper nutrition, absenteeism was epidemic in Bangalore. So the temple president there, he started a program at his own expense. He set up a food kitchen. He got trucks. And he started and he solicited some donations, some matching contributions from the big, big corporations in India. And as it stands now, each meal costs 5 rupees. And corporate India gives 2.5 rupees. And ISKCON contributes the rest. So that program grew from embryonic form about 10 years ago. Now it feeds 2 million children every day. The heat-sealed, thermetic 50-gallon drums are placed in about 15 of these trucks. This is in Bangalore alone. It's spread all over India. And it's a thrilling thing. One time I was standing across the road from the Bangalore temple. Just at the time, they spend all morning cooking. They leave about 9:30, 10 o'clock in order to get to the schools, you know, some of them as much as 50 kilometers away, in time for lunch. And it made my hair rise and gave me goosebumps to be standing across the street and see those trucks coming down the ramp and going this way and this way and this way and this way and delivering those nutritious meals to hundreds and hundreds of thousands of school kids. And needless to say, truancy is no longer epidemic. Kids look forward to going to school. They get a hearty, nutritious midday meal. But that's not the reason for our existence. We don't pat ourselves on the back and say that we are serving God because we're feeding people. It's not the prime reason that we exist. It is a corollary. It is a side issue. The main impetus behind the free food program is not that it nourishes the body today and then requires topping up again tomorrow. The main reason why that program was conceived and was enthusiastically supported was because it's not ordinary food. First of all, there's no meat, there's no fish. It's obtained without violence. So the karmic level is very low. And then finally, every day when these hundreds and hundreds of gallons of khichdi and sabji and dal are cooked, they take little portions of each item, put them on a special plate, and offer them before God. Literally offer them before God. They don't say, thank you, God, for giving us the food. There's a different supposition here. It is saying, God, you created the food. You put the sun and the moon in the sky. You created the DNA and RNA. It's yours. You are the enjoyer. You are the proprietor. Not me. Not me. You are. Now, he doesn't have to eat food and come down and masticate it. But according to his statement in the Bhagavad Gita, patram pushpam phalam tayam yome bhakti prajati, if someone offers me in love and devotion a flower, fruit, leaf, water, grains, or dairy product, I will accept them. So when the offering process is made, it's literally offering it to God, and God from his side enjoys, not the material stuff per se, but the love, devotion, and intelligence with which it's offered. And the name of the foodstuffs changes from before the offering to and after. Before, you have one of these before, and if you can imagine a beautiful plate of samosas and puris and dal and roti, and you have a before picture and you have an after picture. The before is called bhoga, or food which is prepared for one's personal sense enjoyment. And even though it's vegetarian, and the level of karma or reaction is reduced by a huge factor compared to letting the blood of an animal who's a sentient, highly evolved vertebrate who screams and angry to taking cauliflowers and carrots, though the karmic level is reduced by a huge amount, still, for argument's sake, we may say that there's still pain and suffering to some degree involved even in a vegetarian diet. So it's called bhoga, or food which is prepared for personal sense enjoyment. When portions of that are offered to the Lord, the name changes, and then it's called prasadam. P-R-A-S-A-D-M, which means the mercy of the Lord. So here it's you have a picture and you have the caption bhog, and you have the picture here and the caption prasadam, and someone says, well, they look the same. Well, they do look the same. They do look the same, but the quality of it has changed. It is recognized and it has been blessed as the Lord as prasadam, and that means there's no karma in that food. So the devotees wanted to distribute not only nutritious food for the body, but food for the soul. And that program has gone to about a 2 million distribution per day. So what is the International Society for Krishna Consciousness all about? It doesn't buy into the most of the things that society thinks are important to buy into nowadays. It's not that we don't work. It's not that we don't work. We may not be part of the workforce, but it's not that we don't work. We work harder than most people. In Australia, one time someone criticized Prabhupada by saying, well, why don't you work? Prabhupada said, we work harder than you. You couldn't keep up with us. We get up in the pre-dawn hours. We have our ceremony. We have our classes. We chant our rosaries. We go into the kitchen, we cook, we prepare, we go here and there giving lectures. We may have a food distribution program, a college program, and we go to bed 9 or 10 o'clock at night, sleeping about 6 hours. Many of the single celibate students just sleep on a place on the floor. They keep all their belongings in a little locker like this. He said, you couldn't keep up with us. You couldn't keep up with us. It's not that we don't work, but we don't work for the same things that society in general works for. Why do people work? Well, if I didn't work, I wouldn't be able to put food on the table. If I didn't work, I wouldn't be able to have a roof over my head. Baloney. Baloney. God personally guarantees that just as He maintains the ant gets his little crumbs of food every day on one end of the spectrum, and the elephant gets his 500 kgs of food every day. We visited Guru Vayu, the famous Krishna temple in South India, and people donate elephants. They donate elephants, so they've got about 60 elephants. They've said, stop, don't donate any more elephants. But you go, and every one of those 60 elephants is getting 500 kgs of food every day. God is providing them. They don't go to church, they don't go to the temple, they don't go to mosque, they don't chant the holy names of the Lord, they don't say grace, they don't offer their food, and they're getting their maintenance. They're getting shelter, and they're getting food. God is the source of our maintenance. God guarantees that you will get food and you will get roof over your head. He doesn't guarantee that you're going to get a 5-bedroom house for 3 people. He doesn't guarantee that you're going to get a BMW, but you're definitely guaranteed a llama. I'll personally stand in that. I say you'll definitely get a llama if nothing else, or maybe a Toyota Corolla, or maybe a 2-bedroom house. Gandhiji said, there's enough for every man's need, but there's not enough for their greed. So you don't have to work to put food on the table. I'll repeat that. You don't have to work to put food on the table. You don't have to work to put a roof over your head. I'm not saying you don't have to work. I'm not saying that. You see what I'm, you understand? I'm not saying you don't have to work. You don't have to work for your maintenance. You have to work just to keep healthy. You can't sit around watching TV all day. You have to work. You have to be active, be healthy. But you don't have to work for your maintenance. You don't have to work to put food on the table. You don't have to work to get shelter. Because God guarantees that to everyone. So what He's saying is that when you trick yourself or befuddle yourself, that you're working for something which is already guaranteed, you're making your life pointless, purposeless, and miserable. Pointless, purposeless, and miserable. Working for the fruits and thinking that you are the result of the fruits of your labor is the number one cause of dissatisfaction, purposelessness, and misery. Our purpose is not to be here to eat, sleep, mate, and defend. That's not our purpose. The animals eat, sleep, mate, and defend. But we're not animals. We're meant to be something more than animals. If a human being with his and her higher intelligence, higher intellects, simply reduces the reason that they're here for the same accomplishments as the animals, that person will never be happy. Never be happy. Never be happy. And if you're fixed on the fruits, I'm working and I earned this and it's mine, and you better watch out. That's a formula for misery. Formula for misery and meaningless. You have to work. But work for these reasons, Krishna says, not for the so-called fruits. Those are already a given. Of course, we want more than what is basically necessary. Krishna guarantees the basics. He guarantees the basics. So why would we work then? We're not suggesting an alternative of not working, but we're suggesting an alternative of working for the fruits. An alternative to seeing ourselves as the doers and the providers and the enjoyers. And what is that alternative? Work with the talents, abilities, skills that God gave you to please and to satisfy and glorify God. That's why you work. Life should be fun. Life should be fulfilling. Life should be a thrill at every moment. Life should be about love, not just labor. Labor of love. Prabhupada, when he answered that man, that we work harder than you, we just don't toil. What are you doing when you drag yourself to the office to an unfulfilling job? To put food on the table or roof over your head. What are you doing? It's toil. It's not enlivening. It's deadening. Yeah. What are you doing in an unfulfilling job? Why? Because it pays more? Because you can bounce around in a bigger house or drive a more prestigious car? Is that going to make us happy? Stuff? You know what happens when your life centers around stuff instead of when it centers around people? You start using people to get stuff. You start manipulating and exploiting people to get stuff. Instead of seeing all living entities as divine sparks, parts and parcels of God, uniquely crafted and brilliantly endowed by God, you simply see, how can I use them for my own sense gratification? How can I manipulate or exploit them? And that's a formula for happiness? That's a vision that's going to yield happiness? So what is the big picture? What is the International Society for Krishna Consciousness all about? It's not about stuff. It's not about toiling. It's not even about social work or humanitarian work. It's not about that. It's about satisfaction, bliss, glorifying God, reconnecting ourselves with God, and after this short life, going back to the eternal spiritual world from which we come. It's about going back to home, back to God. Anyone think they're going to be able to stay here forever? Anyone think that they've got some special piece of paper or something that whereas everybody throughout the history of the world, hundreds and hundreds of billions of people throughout tens of thousands of years of history, they all had to leave, they all got kicked out, they didn't even usually get notice, they didn't even get time to straighten their socks before they had to be dragged away by cruelty. Anyone think that they're an exception to that? Well, if your hand didn't go up, then we need to understand that this short life is a preparation for the next. That's the meaning. That's the reason we're here. To see how we do. To see how we do. And the International Society for Krishna Consciousness probably called it a purely theological movement. He called it a theological movement based on the principle of pure love for God. In other words, I'm not loving you in order to get something back. That spoils the love. And if we manipulate people to get stuff, then don't we do that to God too? Don't we go to the church and the temple and the mosque with our shopping list? Oh God, could you give me this and give me this? Oh yeah, I almost forgot this. Sort of forgetting that God is the Lord and we're the servants, but rather trying to make the Lord our servants and ourselves the Lord. I mean, if He's the Lord and we're the servants, we should be asking, what can I do for you? Not what can He do for me? So that mood of pure devotion, unmotivated, uninterrupted, it's a flow of love. It's meant to release the natural flow of love between us and God. Kunti, 5,000 years ago, she asked Krishna. She said, Krishna, as the waters course from the Himalayan mountains and go through the flatlands and plains of India and enter into the Bay of Bengal, please bless me that my love, my affection, my energy flows spontaneously to you in love and devotion. So this isn't a limited sectarian denominational enterprise. It's a universal enterprise. The Krishna consciousness movement is not limited to this planet. Krishna consciousness movement, or if you will, God consciousness, is all pervasive. Wherever there's life, wherever there's habitation, there is the effort on God's part to bring errant lost souls back to home, back to Godhead. You know, we had this National Day of Prayer on May the 6th, and I was surprised to learn that from many of the National Day Prayer observances, Mormons, Hindus, and Muslims are excluded. Mormons, Hindus, and Muslims are excluded. And they asked Franklin Graham, the evangelist head of the task force for the National Day of Prayer, why do you exclude these people? Wasn't the National Day of Prayer supposed to be for Americans of all different faiths getting together and celebrating their diversity and their unity at the same time? And Franklin Graham said, they don't worship the same God I worship. They don't worship the same God I worship. Because the God I worship is the only way. He said, I am the way, the truth, and the light, and no man comes to the Father but by me. He's the only way, and everybody else is just out of luck. Everybody else is out of luck. So fortunately, our day of prayer observances organized by Linda Walton are ecumenical, and I'm usually asked to speak. And so I said, God is so great. God is so loving. God is so merciful that He did not, in all time and all places and under all circumstances, only make one effort to redeem His lost, fallen souls. There is not only one conduit to God. And I repeated it. There is not only one conduit to God. Because He's bigger than that. He's bigger than that. And this universe, His creation, is bigger than you think. Is bigger than you think. There are more universes. There are more universes in God's material creation, what to speak of the spiritual creation, than there are mustard seeds in a 100-pound bag of mustard seeds. Has anyone ever counted a 100-pound bag of mustard seeds? Has anyone ever counted how many? And I'm not talking about planets. I'm talking about universes. Each mustard seed is compared to a universe. There are as many universes, sometimes on a sunny day, you'll see beams of sun coming through the window, and you'll see laterally moving through those sunbeams hundreds of thousands of motes of dust, you see. So God creates unlimitedly millions and millions of universes, and there is life not only within each and every universe, but on each and every planet of each and every universe. This isn't the only planet with life. Every planet has life. Just like we have in the United States of America, we have a president, his name was Barack Obama, blah, 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 blah. There's a president of the sun planet. There's a president of the sun planet, it's called Vibhishan. President of the sun planet is called Somar Chandra. There's a president of Indraloka. There's a president, there's a civilization in every planet. Because the nature of soul is that it is not burned, it is not cut, it is not dried, it is not moistened. So it doesn't matter how hot the sun is, soul is not going to be burned. You can't live on the sun planet in this body, of course, but the soul can live on the sun planet with a different organism. Right here in Utah Valley, I mean, it's hard to imagine life existing in Utah Lake, isn't it? It's hard to imagine a place that's had Pacific steel and Geneva steel and all this toxic spewed into it for the last so many years. It's hard to imagine that that would be a life support system. And yet, Utah Lake is teeming with life. I couldn't live there. I would perish within a few seconds on the fumes and the toxins, and also because of the fact I don't have gills and fish and fins. But there is life in Utah Lake. So there is no place in God's creation, there is no orb out there or planet which is not teeming with life. And many of them are more civilized than we are. Time span? One Christian named Bishop Archer, he cross-referenced the Bible and studied for many years, and he came up to a conclusion that the world was created 4,000 years ago on a Friday afternoon. All right? Now, if you're Franklin Graham, you're dealing with a worldview in which this is the only planet that has life in all of God's creation, and we're special, and you're dealing with a time span that might be 4,000 or 5,000 years old, and you're saying there's only one way, one truth, and one life. Well, I can see where you're coming from, but the Vedic idea of time is so vast, so far beyond anything that we can conceive of. Here's a little pie, here's a little graph that shows the four seasons of the universe as they rotate and repeat themselves eternally. The four seasons of the universe are Satya, the golden age, Treta, the silver age, Dwapara, the bronze age, and Kali Yuga, the iron age. The time period in which these four seasons comprise is 4,300,000 years. The golden age is 1.8 million years. The silver age is 1.2 million years. The bronze age is 800,000 years. And the Kali Yuga age, in which we are at present, is 400,000 years. You add all those up and you get 4,300,000 years. That is simply one cosmic year. That's all it is. It's just one year. Just like we have spring, summer, fall, winter, and then what follows? Spring. And it just goes on rotating and rotating and rotating and rotating. Now, Lord Brahma, the creator of this universe, his lifespan is One cycle of four yugas, 4,300,000, times 1,000, that's his one day. That's his one day. 4,300,000 times 1,000 is his one day. His 24-hour period, day and night, is 4,300,000 times 1,000 times 2. His week is that figure times 7. His month is that figure times 4. His year is that figure times 12. And he lives for 100 years. And that's just one manifestation. That's one manifestation. And when you calculate that out by our time span, it's 311 trillion years. That's a period of one cosmic manifestation. And at the end of that, there's an annihilation. There's a pure, equal period of non-manifestation. And then there's another manifestation. And it goes on eternally. And that 311 trillion years, by our calculation, is one exhalation of God. Vishnu. He exhales, and from his breathing and his pores, the universes come like little golden eggs and grow. He exhales, and that period is 311 trillion years by our calculation, and then he inhales. And there's an equal period of non-manifestation, and then he exhales again. And then he exhales. So considering the time period that we're talking about, considering the populations and planets that we're talking about, are you serious? Are you serious? That God, the all-merciful, all-powerful Lord, he's only got one plan for us to go back to home, back to Godhead? I'm not in any way trying to invalidate or discredit Lord Jesus Christ. Those who are his sincere followers, they will. That is a conduit. That is a bona fide conduit. But if you risk religious bigotry and you insult the Lord by claiming a franchise on mercy, that's going to be cross-productive. So be very careful. Be very, very careful about your discounting the mercy and the grandeur of God. One Christian preacher, I heard him say, he said, it says in John 16, I am the way, I am the truth, I am the light. No mother comes to the Father but by me. He says, I am betting my life on the truth of that statement. If that statement is not true, we might as well close up shop and go home because there is no such thing as Christianity. When I heard that, I said, how pathetic can you get? How pathetic can you get? If God isn't that small, then I quit. I'm not going to play. If God isn't in my hip pocket, but he's in someone else's pocket and someone else's pocket, and there's various conduits to go back to home, back to God. There are various efforts, there are various universal enterprises since all time and all space. If that's true, I quit and I go home. But that's so sad. So sad. God is not franchised, you see. He's unlimited. He's inconceivable. And you'll never begin to know God until you know this, that he is inconceivable. He is inconceivably great. Nobody can claim to know the length and breadth and height of his greatness or his mercy. It is said that the infinitesimal cannot comprehend the infinite. That's true. An ant can't understand the internet. So we can't understand God. However, the infinite can reveal itself to some degree or other to the infinitesimal. So by our own efforts, we can't comprehend God who is unlimited. But he can reveal himself to the degree that he wishes to reveal himself to the sincere aspirant. So that's the crux of the International Society for Krishna Consciousness. When we chant Hare Krishna, Krishna Krishna, Hare Hare, Hare Rama, Hare Rama, Rama Rama, Hare Hare, we're acknowledging that we're not here to order God around, that we're here to serve him. And he's given each and every one of us unique talents and abilities and capacities, brilliant things. But oftentimes we minimize those. We discount those because we have to make a salary. We have to drive a Porsche. We have to have a big house. We have to have all the baubles and whistles. And we sacrifice our own eternal soul for all the trinkets that are out there. We should choose our occupation based on what we like to do, what we're good at. And we should dedicate that to the person that endowed us with those talents and abilities. And that's the only way we'll ever be happy. So when we chant Hare Krishna, Krishna Krishna, Hare Hare, Hare Rama, Hare Rama, Rama Rama, Hare Hare, we're saying, Lord, it's a prayer. People say, do you pray? Yeah, we pray. But we don't pray for anything except this. Lord, engage me in your service. Engage me. How you made me, how you created me, what you planned for me to do before I was born, lock me in, Lord. Plug me in. That's what I want. I want what you want. I want what you created me to be. Because it's not about me. You know, the bookstores are full of self-help books. You got to do this. You got to take control of your destiny. You got to get rid of your bad habits. You got to dream and so on. There's one problem. They're good up to a point. I mean, I take advantage of them myself. But there's a problem with them. There's a problem with them. Because it's not about you. It's not about you. It's not about you. You didn't create this world. You don't own it. And you don't have a design for it. But God did. He created you. He owns everything. He designed you. He has a plan. And the plan is to live this short life, 60 or 70 years, in an ideal, virtuous, ecstatic, fulfilling way. Never mind what your salary is. Never mind how many times you get your name in the newspaper. Never mind, you know, whether you get the Heisman Trophy. Never mind. Just be diligent, be righteous, serve the Lord, glorify the Lord for 60 or 70 years. And then after that, trillions and trillions and trillions of years in the spiritual world, in the kingdom of God. And this world has three characteristics: asat, achit, and nirananda. It is temporary, it is miserable, and it is also ignorant. That's why we all have to go to school, because we're basically ignorant and we need to accumulate knowledge. And that world is satchidananda. That world is eternal, full of knowledge and full of bliss. So a few years here, tempered, character building, flexing our spiritual muscles and talents, and then it's a dress rehearsal. It's a dry run. It's the warm-up lap, you see. And then over there, trillions and trillions and trillions of years in the spiritual world. This International Society for Krishna Consciousness is for that purpose. For that purpose, that by taking advantage of the knowledge and the practices of offering the foodstuffs and chanting, one will purify one's existence, come to know who we are, why we're here, and who God is, and at the end of this life, go back home, back to God. Like Prabhupada said in the Wayside Chapel, what is the good of this Krishna consciousness? It saves you from death. It saves you from death. I did a funeral on Monday in Wasatch Lawn Mortuary. Gita Shah passed away at the age of 32. She was a board certified architect. She was a world-class flutist. She ran 3 marathons. She did triathlon. She was a tennis champion. I can't even tell you all the things. 32 years old. 32 years old. She passed away. And at the end of the eulogy, I said, look, I said, they said, in the program, it said, give a blessing. It said, give a blessing. Okay, I said to everyone, it was a packed chapel, about 400 people, about half Western, half Indians. I said, I wish this for all of you. This is what I wish for each and every one of you. Om asato mad sadgamya, om tamasho mad jyotirgamya, om nitam maramitam gamya, om shanti shanti shanti. This is what I wish. It's not how long you live, but it's how well you live. The trees live, there's sequoias that live for 5,000 years. But is the tree more important than the soul in a human form of life? It's not how many breaths you take. There are bellows that breathe. They're not more important than we are. It's not how long you live, but it's how you live. Whether you live 30 years or 60 years or 70, it is a finger snap. It is a finger snap, that's all. And it is well invested, you see, to serve the Lord, to glorify the Lord, and then go back home, back to God. Om Asato Mad Sadgamya. I bless you that you go from this temporal world to the eternal world. Om Tamasho Mad Jyotirgamya. I bless you And you go from this world of darkness, where the light is artificial by sun and moon, to that self-effulgent world. Om Nitam Maram Nitam Gamaya, I bless you. I wish this for you. And you go from the world of death, where everybody dies. Everybody dies, to the world of deathlessness. This girl had breast cancer. She had a 2-year battle. It seemed to have gone away for some time. And then in January, someone suggested she have an MRI, and it was everywhere. It was everywhere, riddled throughout her body. It was everywhere. And then she was designated as terminal. She will not survive. Well, I have news for you. You're also terminal. I'm also terminal. You're not going to survive. I'm not going to survive. Nobody gets out alive. Last time I checked, the mortality rate was 100%. You may go at 32 or 35 or 51 or 62. You may go tomorrow or the next day or not for quite a few many more days. But we are terminal. We are terminal. And what are we going to do about it? It's not how long we breathe or how long we flap along. It's about how we live this life and if we live it in such a way as to go back home, back to Godhead. It saves you from death. It saves you from death. Now, do you really think liberation awaits those people who worship stuff? Do you think those people who orient their life around stuff, who manipulate other people for stuff, who go to the church and temple and mosque and ask God for stuff, do you think that liberation awaits them at the end of this life? You honestly think that? I believe, I believe, I believe, I believe, hallelujah. Sometimes I think they're just kidding themselves. They're just working themselves up into a fantasy. Because it doesn't matter what religion or faith or denomination that you may be a card-carrying member of. If you're attached to stuff, you're going to come back. And you're going to get another body of stuff. Of earth, air, fire, water, mucus, blood, phlegm, stool, urine. Because in order to enjoy stuff, you need to have a body made of stuff. You see. We're going to have another body at the end of this life. But it's up to us how we live this life, whether that next body be an eternal spiritual body or whether it be a material body. The body is an instrument to fulfill our desires. So if our desires are material, if our desires are for stuff, then we get a material body. If our desires are to serve God, then we get an eternal spiritual body to continue serving Him in the spiritual world. Oh, I'm sorry, I probably only went through 3 slides there, didn't I?